15th of November 2011, the Lamrim Meditation class. We're going through these graded stages of the path, and we have to just give a very brief overview and review, not a very detailed one today. We've covered the initial and intermediate scopes of motivation, the initial motivation being to improve our future lives, to make sure that we continue to have a precious human rebirth, and the intermediate level, which is to work to attain liberation so that we don't have any rebirths, uncontrollably recurring rebirths at all, and all the problems and sufferings and the causes of sufferings that are involved there. And now we're on the advanced scope of motivation, which is to work toward the enlightened state of the Buddha so that we can be of best help to everyone. In the initial scope, we covered the precious human rebirth, appreciating what it is, its causes, etc., and it's not going to last for long. We went into the death meditation. Death will come for sure. We never know when. And nothing is going to be of help except having taken preventive measures to avoid a downfall to a worse rebirth state. In other words, Dharma measures. And we looked at the worst rebirth states that could follow if we haven't taken these preventive measures, what a rebirth would be like in a so-called hell realm as a clutching ghost or as some sort of creeping creature or an animal. Just imagine if we had the brain of a chicken or the brain of a fly, as of the hardware that we could know things through, how much would we be able to understand? How much positive things would we be able to do? We would be severely limited by the hardware of that rebirth. That's what's so awful about these rebirths, these worst rebirth states, that aside from the suffering and the unhappiness and the pain and tortures of the hell realms and so on, we don't have the working basis, the brain even, to be able to let it, or the body, to be able to, or the facility to speak, to understand, to teach, you know, anything like that. We're missing all of that. So that's really quite horrible when you think about it. Then we developed a healthy sense of fear of that. We really don't want that to happen. And we see, though, that there's a way out, so we don't feel helpless. There's a way to avoid that. It's not hopeless, and that's to put a safe and positive direction in our life, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, to work to achieve that true stopping of the causes of any type of rebirth and sufferings and so on that's involved with it, and the states of mind, the understanding that will bring that about and result from that. The way the Buddhists have that in full, and the Arya Sangha has it in part. And the first thing to do is to avoid the causes for the worst rebirth state, this destructive behavior, and that led to the full discussion of karma. So in order to attain better human rebirth, we need to have ethical discipline to refrain from acting destructively when we feel like acting destructively because of disturbing emotions and so on. And that has to be fortified, strengthened by sincere prayers for precious human rebirth, you know, so we're really aiming for that, dedicating, you know, whatever positive force we build up toward at least that, and supplemented by the other far-reaching attitudes, generosity, patience, again, ethical discipline, perseverance, and concentration, and discriminating awareness, using our intelligence. Then, the intermediate scope, we saw that any type of rebirth state, still under the influence of at least the naivety about how we exist, how you exist, how everybody exists, and so on. And this also is quite awful. And we looked at the sufferings of the better rebirth states, the type of happiness that we might have doesn't last, never satisfies. We have too much of it, it becomes painful and unpleasant, like eating too much of our favorite food, giving us a stomach ache, and all of that is just boring. We want to get rid of that. Any type of uncontrollably recurring rebirth, what a drag, to have to be a baby over and over again and have old age and to never get what we want and always have things happen to us that we don't want, like losing our job and getting sick and growing old and all of these sort of things. What a drag. So we then look at the causes for this, and it's not just destructive behavior, it's even constructive behavior under the influence of naivety about how we exist and so on, with which I've got to be perfect, I've got to be good, this sort of perfectionism, compulsive and so on. We saw that the main aspect of karma is compulsiveness, compulsively based on previous negative habits or naivety. We looked at all the disturbing emotions, the primary ones, the secondary ones, and how they function, and so on. And then we looked at the whole cycle in general of death, pardu, and rebirth, and then the specific mechanism of how it works with the 12 links of dependent arising, starting from unawareness about how we exist and everybody else exists. And then we saw that with renunciation of all of this, that we've really got to get out, we're determined to be free, we are willing to give up suffering and its causes, give up this uncontrollably recurring rebirth, which means give up being under the influence of biological factors and all this other stuff, and work to develop discriminating awareness, a higher discriminating awareness of voidness, Four Noble Truths, etc. And for that, we need higher concentration, and for that, we need the training in higher ethical discipline in terms of keeping vows and so on. So we discussed all of that. That was the intermediate scope, and now we're up to the advanced scope. And with the advanced scope, we have covered basically an introduction to what bodhicitta is and the benefits of developing it. Bodhicitta is a very, very vast state of mind, which is brought on by love and compassion for absolutely everybody, all beings whatsoever, equally. Wish for them all to be happy, not to be unhappy, to not have the causes for happiness, and to be free from the causes of unhappiness. And we take responsibility to bring that, help them to achieve that. And the really exceptional resolve that I'm going to help them to achieve enlightenment, not just help them across the street. And I'm going to do this even if I have to do it myself. So this is very, very strong resolve. And then bodhicitta is being focused at our not yet happened enlightenment, which can happen on the basis of our Buddha nature potentials and abilities, with the intention to attain it and with the intention to benefit all others by means of that attainment, and of course to try to benefit them as much as possible all along the way. So that was bodhicitta. And we spoke about the benefits of developing that last week. So let's continue today. I'd like to follow what Tsongkhapa does here in his Lamrim Chemo, this called Grand Presentation of the Graded Stages of the Path. He says, therefore, and I'll quote, I'm translating his words, therefore it is not sufficient that the Dharma teachings be a Mahayana Dharma. It is crucial that the person be someone that can be included or counted as a Mahayanist. Since even functioning as a Mahayanist depends on having a bodhicitta aim, then if you have nothing more than a mere understanding of that aim, then your being a Mahayanist will also be like that, will just be a mere understanding of what it's like to be one. Since if the bodhicitta aim you have is fully definitional, then your being a Mahayanist will also be come to be perfectly pure. Make effort in this. So this is what he's saying, that it's not sufficient that what you're studying is Mahayana. You have to actually become a Mahayana person, which means that not just based on understanding what bodhicitta is. A lot of people translate that as intellectual understanding. I find that putting it into Western categories. I don't know that intellectual understanding really is the point here. The point is, to just understand it is not enough, to be able to rattle off the definition and all of that. But it has to be the real thing. And the real thing, we would say in Western terms, means that you have feeling for it, and that feeling is sincere, which means that we really mean it. We really have compassion. We really have it for everybody. We really have love. We really have it for everybody equally. That's not easy. Not at all. Usually, if we have it at all, it's for just a few. A few people, maybe our pet dog or something like that, the ones that we like. But to extend it to absolutely everybody, and we're not just talking about people we don't like, but to extend it to all the insects and, absolutely every being in the universe, and to really not only mean that, but to be able to conceive of that is really quite exceptional. So, I don't really know what understand means, what he's saying here. To say understand, he uses the word koa, which is just a regular colloquial word to mean to understand. It doesn't mean that we have a what's called an ascertainment of it, that it's definitional, that it's decisive and accurate, and all of that. I'm not sure that it necessarily means that, but it could be a little bit more vague than that. We've heard the teachings, and we can recite the words, and we have some vague understanding. But even to have an accurate and decisive understanding of it, so that you can debate it and so on, I think that also is not enough. He's saying you really have to have it fully definitional. Fully definitional means that you actually develop it. So in our Western terms, as I said, it means that you actually feel it. So what do you think of that? That, I think, applies to everything in the Dharma. And what does it mean to feel something? As opposed to just understanding it. And let's not get into intellectual versus intuitive, because that could mean different things to different people. So those are quite difficult to define. So let's just talk about plain, simple English terms, to understand and to feel something. What's the difference? What does it mean to feel something? Yeah.
I can think of an example in psychotherapy, you sometimes you talk about stuff.
Can you speak louder, please?
In psychotherapy, you talk about stuff and you realize that there's this or that problem or this and this pattern. But some people can't access, the feeling, what it's like, and maybe work with that. It's just intellectual, I don't want to use the term, but for some people it's just superficial, and then there's the further step of getting this more, to the gut level.
Right. There is a saying that an analogy would be in psychotherapy, some people might be able to talk about their problems, but to actually access their feelings about it and so on might be more difficult. So to actually feel something, we're talking about emotions, what we would call emotions. Remember, there's no Tibetan or Sanskrit word for emotion. They just talk about positive ones and disturbing ones. So in this case, it would be to have a actual positive emotion here, like love and compassion. And the actual intention, and not just say, I want to achieve enlightenment. May this be for the benefit of all sentient beings. You just recite that like a nursery rhyme. It doesn't mean anything. But to really mean it. I think that's part of it. Emotional often we think of emotional dukkha in slightly disturbing sense. It's hard to think, maybe I'm wrong, in our Western way of thinking, that emotional seems to be the opposite of rational. And here, in the Buddhist context, we want the two to be together. Don't we?
I was thinking in terms of the left hemisphere of the brain, like the rational ideas, and the right hemisphere that is more, you know, complete picture, that puts everything together and is more natural.
So, I mean, he's going with the left and right hemisphere. So the left hemisphere more rational, the right hemisphere more emotional, artistic, holistic, and so on. And what we want is a combination of the two here. So can you imagine? Yeah, because often when you're very emotional, you lose control as well, don't you? In a sense. And that's part of the definition of a disturbing emotion, that you lose peace of mind and self-control. So you feel so compassionate, well, what are you doing? You're crying and you're out of control. So that's certainly not that. Yeah, you
too. I can't quite put my finger on it, but I think that empathy is a really important term in that context.
Empathy is very important in the context. You're right. That's when we talk about compassion, that's, you know, the strongest aspect of it is empathy. Mm-hmm. Just as we would want our own to be free of our own unhappiness and suffering, you empathize with others and theirs, and then you feel exactly the same, you know, strength of wish for them to be free, just as we would wish for ourselves to be free. So it's very strong empathy.
The human connection that you make by sharing their feeling rather than understanding their feeling.
I see. The human connection of sharing their feeling rather than just understanding it. Can you do that with the feeling of a mosquito?
Probably not.
Probably not. That's more difficult. Mm. Yeah, well, what can I do? You know, I have this kind of rebirth and that's what I eat is blood. And anybody who sees me just wants to swat me, you know. What can I do? This is what I eat. That's pretty terrible karma, isn't it? You try to empathize with a mosquito. So, to feel it, you know, when we talk about bodhicitta, there's the labored and the unlabored state. Labored means that you have to go through steps, put in labor or effort in order to generate it, which means there, we'll get into this later on. There are two sequences of steps with which we can work ourselves up to actually feeling this bodhicitta sincerely. So that means that every single step on the way, we need to have the appropriate emotion, but the appropriate emotion, whether we're talking about the initial scope, what was the main emotion there? It was, dread and fear. I don't want to have a lower rebirth, and I see that there is a way out to avoid that. So it's rational. You know, it's not an irrational fear. It's not a fear that cripples you. It is a healthy, rational, like, fear is too strong a word. But like, for instance, why are you careful when you drive? Why are you careful when you cross the street to look both ways? Because you don't want an accident, you don't want to be hit. So there is that strong wish to avoid the terrible, you know, terrible things that could happen. And you know that if I'm careful, I can avoid that in most cases. So it's rational. You call that fear, dread. Well, as I said, our word fear, that's why I was saying always that it's a healthy sense of fear with which we take precautions. It's not one of these, you know, makes you nervous wreck and paranoid and so on, not that kind of fear. So how do you translate it? That's hard to say, but it is a rational emotional feeling. It's based on reason. That this is certainly something that is reasonable, that I don't want that, and it's reasonable that I can avoid it. And then with renunciation, it's also a strong, sincere feeling, the intermediate scope. I'm bored, I'm disgusted with this type of uncontrollably recurring rebirth. Just these ups and downs, totally boring, had enough, and I want to get out. But it's based on understanding and confidence that there is a way out. And so you just do it. So there's a great deal of strength with both these motivations, isn't there? Strength and courage. And conviction. But feeling. So this is interesting, you know? That's why I say, to say intellectual, intuitive, I mean, this is too vague. Too vague. So this is what Tsongkhapa is saying, that you really need it. You know, if you can do Mahayana, it has to be the real thing. Now, this gets into a whole big discussion of what is often translated as the two collections. How do you know, develop it? You know, what do you need in order to attain enlightenment, the Mahayanas? So when we talk about, you know, I was translating them as positive force and deep awareness rather than merit and, what do they call it, insight or wisdom, something like that. So there are two ways of looking at them. And when we talk about what I translate, what people translate as collection, I've been calling a network, that is just one interpretation of it. There are two usages, two ways of working with that word, sambara, in Sanskrit. According to Haribhadra's commentary to Maitreya's Abhisamaya Alankara, this is the main Indian commentary of the main thing that Tibetans study, this Abhisamaya Alankara, filigree of realizations, what goes through an incredibly detailed presentation of all the different meditations and stages that you need all along the path. Much, much more detailed than Lamrim. And Haribhadra defines this term as a pure builder, literally. In other words, it is something that builds up a pure state of either liberation or enlightenment. And that's referring to positive force and deep awareness, and depending on whether it's dedicated with renunciation toward achieving liberation, or dedicated toward enlightenment with bodhicitta, becomes either a liberation builder or a enlightenment builder. That's so the way that he uses it, the way that he defines it, it's only referring to each particular act. He's not talking about the way that they network together. This idea of networking, so he doesn't call what we do with ordinary positive force, you know, based on samsara. He doesn't call that a samsara builder positive force, but by extension we could understand like that. So either it's samsara building or it's liberation or enlightenment building. But there's another way of looking at it according to the Buddha nature teachings, and there in those texts we talk about a basis level, a path level, and a resultant level, and there we have this network, as it were, of positive force that is a basis Buddha nature factor, can be on the path level it's partially pure, partially impure, and then on the resultant level that's perfectly pure. So there are two ways of looking at this. And then if we think in terms of this liberation building and enlightenment building, let's just talk about enlightenment building. So we have this enlightenment building acts, and they can somehow network together. There are what are called facsimile ones and the actual ones. The facsimile are before you attain, you know, one of these pathway minds. So before you attain unlabored bodhicitta, and right, so when you have labored bodhicitta, that would be the facsimile. And the real thing, the actual thing, is when it's unlabored. Unlabored, I didn't finish what I was explaining. Labored is when you have to build it up step by step by step. You have to feel every step. And unlabored is when you're so familiar with that that you can instantly go to and have that bodhicitta without having to work yourself up to it by all these stages. And that's the real thing. When you don't have to, you see, that's why intellectual doesn't work, because you could also say, from our Western point of view, that when you have to build it up step by step, that that's intellectual. But this isn't what we mean. What we mean is as I was saying, one is without emotion, one is with some sort of emotion. And even when it's with emotion, you can build it up by step, or you can just automatically feel it, the full thing. You seem a little puzzled. You want some time to think about that? Let's take some time to think about that. So, we have these various stages. What this whole discussion is leading to is, how do you actually get, you know, a bodhicitta? How do you get that? How do you go from a, you know, samsara building network to a pure building network? And that's a very difficult question. So if we do positive, you know, most of the time we do negative things, so it builds up negative force, because we act under the influence of disturbing emotions. Disturbing emotions builds up negative force. You know, anger and greed and so on. Then you cheat and you lie and you harm others and so on. Yell at them. Say cruel things. So, without the disturbing emotions, still we act compulsively, you know, the do-gooder. You know, I've got to be a good girl, I've got to be a good boy type of thing. So it's still a big ego type of thing. That just builds up samsara. That samsara building positive force will lead to nicer samsara, which is not what we want. Although, you need nicer samsara, because you need a precious human rebirth. But how do we possibly go from that to an enlightenment building force? That's the real question. And with the enlightenment building force, there's the facsimile one, where you have to work, you know, by stages to build up, and then the real thing. So you see the problem here. So it's very interesting. To act as a cause for enlightenment, that bodhicitta that we have, you know, there's two opinions, whether the whether the pure builder will start, you know, with the facsimile or not. So that we can't decide. One set of textbooks says one thing, one set says the other thing. But in either case, you don't need single-minded concentration. And you don't need the understanding of voidness in order for, you know, positive force to be enlightenment building. Of course it helps, and that will make it stronger, but you don't need that. That will come along the way. It starts before that. So it starts before we have single-minded concentration, starts before we have what should we call it? non-conceptual. Bodhicitta is never going to be non-conceptual until we're a Buddha, because we can only focus on enlightenment through some sort of the category enlightenment and something representing it. We can't actually focus straightforwardly on enlightenment until we're enlightened. So it's always conceptual up until enlightenment. But even, you know, for that deep awareness, the understanding of voidness, it doesn't have to be non-conceptual. It doesn't have to be with single-pointed concentration, but it has to be, you know, just, what should we say? For bodhicitta, that's what we're talking about here. It has to be with feeling, sincere, whether it's labored or unlabored. Okay, now. And to get enlightenment, you need both, obviously, the deep awareness and the positive force. Okay, following me so far. Now, Tsongkhapa goes into a lovely discussion. He quotes various sutras as the source for this. First of all, the four conditions for developing a bodhicitta aim. It's interesting. Even before this, how can you develop bodhicitta? You know, this gets into what I want to develop, this whole idea of, how do you become enlightened? Why hasn't everybody become enlightened already? And with that, first of all, you need a precious human rebirth. To get a precious human rebirth, you have to have the causes, as we were saying in our introduction. So, causes are this ethical discipline. Ethical discipline means refraining from acting out destructive emotions. Ignorance is beginningless. Discriminating awareness with which we discriminate, I don't want to do this. That's not beginningless. I mean, the mental factor is there. You can discriminate between light and dark, but not cultivated to this point of what's beneficial or not beneficial. So many things, and to be able to meet a teacher. You have to have all the causes. And then you have to develop, initial scope and intermediate scope. So a tremendous amount of things have to come together already, before even these conditions can be met. So what are these conditions? Number one, I'm translating Tsongkhapa, having either seen for oneself the inconceivable strong abilities of Buddhas or Bodhisattvas, strong abilities, it's a difficult word to know exactly what it's referring to. I think it's referring to the extrasensory and extraphysical powers, enlightening influence of a Buddha. Having seen these sort of strong abilities, strengths, or heard about them from a trustworthy person, developing bodhicitta by thinking how powerful that enlightenment is that they abide in and work towards. The strength and powers of a Buddha to be able to, help everybody and influence everybody and all these things. We're so impressed by that we want to work toward that. A lot of people are impressed by such shows of strength and power. Second, like these contests of extra-physical powers and extrasensory powers that you read about in the scriptures. So second, mind you, this comes out of a sutra. Second, even if you haven't seen or heard about it, yet having read or listened to the scriptures that were composed from unsurpassed enlightenment, having firm conviction, which also means aspiration for the deep awareness of the Buddhas. In other words, you read these scriptures, you read all these things, and you say, wow, only an omniscient mind could have written these things. They're so intertwined, so complex, especially with the tantras. And so many different levels of meaning in them, and so on, that only, if somebody really were an omniscient Buddha, could they possibly have written this? And so you're really impressed by that, and that's what, so you have, real conviction in this and aspiration. This is what I'd like to achieve. So you're either impressed by the powers of a Buddha, or you're impressed by the incredible things that Buddha taught and wrote. Well, he didn't write, but were written down for what he taught. The third one, even if you haven't heard the Dharma, yet having seen that the... So this is talking about the conditions. What would inspire you to even want to develop bodhicitta? Even if you haven't heard the Dharma, yet having seen that the pure bodhisattva Dharma is disappearing, then developing bodhicitta by thinking, I will definitely develop bodhicitta in order for this bodhisattva Dharma to endure for a long time, since if this Dharma endures, you can help eliminate the sufferings of countless limited beings. I find this is one that I'm very attracted to. That you see, wow, you know, the Dharma is degenerating and so on, and this Dharma is so fantastic, it helps so many beings and can help. It's so incredible that I want to develop bodhicitta so I can help preserve the Dharma and bring it to others so it can help them. This is another condition why you would develop bodhicitta. And then fourth, even if you haven't seen that the Dharma is disappearing, yet seeing how difficult it is to develop bodhicitta, then developing bodhicitta by thinking, in this terrible time when there's so much naivety, lack of self-dignity, lack of concern for how one's actions reflect on others, you know, low consideration of others, jealousy and envy and miserliness and stinginess, then in these times, even the development of the aim for the purified state of a Shravaka or a Pratyeka Buddha is difficult to find. What need to mention developing the bodhicitta aim for the unsurpassed purified state? It's a classic way of saying things in Tibetan and Sanskrit. If I at some time develop bodhicitta, others as well will do like that. So, you're thinking that, it's such a terrible time and people are so, terribly disturbed. It's greed and jealousy and, being immoral and so on. That if I develop bodhicitta, then I can inspire others to do so. So these would be the conditions. So think, do I have any of these conditions? I'm so impressed by the powers of the Buddha, or I'm so impressed by the intelligence behind the teachings, or I am so moved that, the Dharma is disappearing. I have to preserve it because it can benefit so many. Or, people are in such bad shape, I need to set the example. Do we have any of these? You don't need all of them. One is enough. And Tsongkhapa says, for how bodhicitta develops from these conditions, as has been said, quote, they cause one to develop the aim toward great enlightenment. In other words, you develop the wish to attain enlightenment from that, by this condition. It could be more than one, of course. So, what do you think? It gives a lot to think about. We're not just talking here, what usually we hear in the discussion of bodhicitta, just develop love and compassion and equanimity and all these things. That comes after that. This is the basis. What would make you even have interest in bodhicitta? In enlightenment? Why would you be interested in it? Assuming that you have, from all the incredible causes of a precious human rebirth and at the right time and the teachings are available, that you've met the teachings and met the teachers and heard of, you know, Buddha and, you know, read something about it or encountered somebody. Even then, a lot of people could say, so what? You're not moved by it, not impressed by it. So we'd have to have one of these. That, you know, wow, these powers are fantastic. And, you know, that's impressive. I'd like to develop that. This could be of help to others, not just, you know, I can be powerful. Or, you know, wow, the intelligence behind this is incredible. You know, I'd like to become like that. Or this could be of so much help. You know, it's terrible that it's disappearing. I've got to preserve it, make it available. Or everybody's in such bad shape, I've got to set an example. Wonderful points. Any comments? Not much to comment. Just a lot to digest in terms of, you know, where am I at?
I was just wondering if maybe the last point is the most emotional, isn't it? Like the first three are more like rational, like I want to be like this, or I want to preserve the teachings, or you know. But the last one is really where it gets juicy. That you really feel I want to turn myself into an example.
They can say it's emotional, but. And only the last one is emotional. Well, I mean, all of these are, what should we say? They're slightly different in terms of the, our word emotion is very vague here. There can be a lot of feeling behind all of these. But the first... Pardon?
It really travels out.
I want to set an example to others, but also I want to preserve the teaching so it's available to others. So that's also there. Anyway, there are four ways in which this happens, Tsongkhapa says, in which you develop the wish from these four. Regardless of which of the four conditions it arises from. So, first one, having become astounded from seeing or hearing about the amazing extraphysical powers of emanation to help everybody. Now here, Tsongkhapa is a little bit more clear about what he's talking about. You know, Buddha can emanate, you know, and speak every language and emanate in all sorts of forms and help everybody. So having become astounded by that, thinking I shall attain enlightenment like that. Yes, I can help everybody, you know, like the way Buddha does. Second, from hearing about the excellent qualities of a Buddha from a Dharma teacher, first developing belief that they are true, that they're real, that's a tough one, and then developing the wish to attain them. So, and Tsongkhapa said, this could come from any of these conditions. So let's say, you know, I want to preserve the Dharma. So that's the condition that's brought me there, and then I hear about these qualities, and then on the basis of that, I develop belief that they're real, that they're true. That's a very, as I said, that's a really difficult one. And then developing wish to attain them. And then third, I mean, all of these also seem to be related, you know, one to each of these specific ones, but it says that it could come from all four. From being unable to bear that the Mahayana teachings are disappearing, developing the wish to attain the deep awareness of a Buddha. Deep awareness of a Buddha, that's the term that's referring to the, you know, this whole list of the qualities of the Buddha's mind, you know, the 10 forces, the 4 guarantees about which he's fearless, 4 perfect awareness, and it's a whole long list. Here, Tsongkhapa goes on, here, even though seeing that if the teachings don't disappear, the sufferings of limited beings can be turned away, and so, having your aim being for the sake of eliminating the suffering of others, nevertheless, the main condition here for developing bodhicitta is not being unable to bear that the teachings is the main condition here for developing bodhicitta is being unable to bear that the teachings are disappearing. Otherwise, this would be a repeat of developing bodhicitta by relying on compassion, as explained below. So it's not that we're relying on compassion. The reason that we develop bodhicitta is being in this third one is being unable to bear that the teachings are disappearing. So it's not that you're developing compassion as the strongest thing. No, I mean, this is how that third one more specifically would develop. And it's interesting. That's interesting because I find that this is, you know, what I personally am driven by with the website and everything. That the compassion is secondary. What really is the focus that drives me on, at least, is that, you know, I can't bear to see these precious things disappearing because they're so incredibly fantastic and helpful. So I find this very true, that that can give you the strength to, you know, got to get it together and not be lazy and not, you know, be discouraged and not think that it's too much and just do it.
But isn't it also compassion?
Yes, but he says that's not the main cause. Otherwise, this isn't a separate category. And then the fourth one, from seeing how rare this meaningful bodhicitta aim is, developing the wish to attain Buddhahood by being spurred on principally by that. So that was his third one. It's so rare to develop it that, and everybody else is in such, you know, horrible shape that I've got to do it. Nobody else is doing it. I've got to do it, and then I can set the example. In a sense, I can think in terms of myself also. I mean, I've had unbelievably rare opportunities to study with the greatest of the great teachers of the last generation. And this is so incredibly rare. There's so few of us Westerners who had that opportunity. So few, a handful. That it would be ridiculous waste if I didn't do something with it. So I can relate to that one as well. So the question is, can you relate to any of these? And if you can't, what would you need as the causes for being able to be moved by any of these conditions? And then you start to see the importance of all the previous stages of the Lamrim. Precious human rebirth, not waste the time that I have, take advantage of it, refrain from destructive behavior, build up these, you know, the samsaric positive force. Samsaric positive force is what's going to give you the precious human rebirth. Isn't it? And meeting with the teacher and so on, even if you don't have, you know, may I meet with my teachers in future lives? Future samsaric lives. But even so, you need that. And it's only if you build up a tremendous amount of this samsaric positive force that you could, you know, ever start to build up this pure enlightenment building positive force. And here's the catch, because to build up that positive force, samsaric building one, you have to be able to not act, you have to be able to use discriminating awareness to discriminate, this is intelligence, that if I act under the basis of the compulsive feeling, you know, to yell at somebody or to hit somebody or so on, borne on by disturbing emotions, it's just going to produce suffering. And then you exercise the self-control not to. So it's only with that that you'll be able to build up positive samsara, building positive force. Yeah, that you say, no, I'm not going to yell. I'm not going to let myself be driven on by anger and greed and attachment and so on. Now, what are you fighting? Unawareness is beginningless. That level of intelligence, discriminating awareness, is not just the basic, you know, ability to discriminate is there. Build up some positive force, and that positive force is either, it's not cumulative, because it ripens and then it's finished, or we destroy it by disturbing emotions. So, how can you build up enough to overcome this natural tendency that's there to deplete that positive force? The samsaric building one. That's the real issue.
Because dedication is for the enlightenment building.
Dedication is for enlightenment building. And then what he's saying, you know, and this is the question, if you're dedicated just with blah, 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 the words, that's what Tsongkhapa said in the what I said in the beginning of the class, it doesn't do anything. You have to actually feel it. You have to actually feel it. But even to get to the stage where you say, blah, 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 I dedicate this for, you know, reaching enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings, even that's an accomplishment. So, that's why Shantideva says, a positive thought is like a flash of lightning in the sky. You know? With all the darkness of our negative thoughts. And this negative stuff is canceling out the positive stuff all the time. Because it's beginningless. So these are the things that I'm thinking of as I'm trying to develop this theme of why haven't we all become enlightened yet? Despite the fact that there's beginningless time. So, these conditions, you know, are very important to try to accumulate, try to build up. Very, very wonderful teaching. Tsongkhapa goes on. These ways of developing bodhicitta have been set from the gateway of developing the wish to attain enlightenment. They do not seem to have been set from the gateway of the purpose for which one would attain it. In other words, they are, remember there's two intentions with bodhicitta. One is to attain enlightenment, and the other is to benefit all beings. So what Tsongkhapa is referring to here, which I had never seen emphasized before until I really started reading, you know, carefully Tsongkhapa in Tibetan, is that you have to build up causes for both of these intentions. It's not just the compassion side, which is to benefit all beings. You have to build the other side up as well, the wish to attain enlightenment. And so these conditions are conditions for why would you want to achieve enlightenment? And we're not talking about what you would do once you've achieved enlightenment, which is to benefit all beings. And of course, not, I want to achieve enlightenment because that's the highest, that's an ego trip. And of course, it's not, you know, because I'm so impressed by the powers of the Buddha, I want to attain that so that I'll be powerful. I mean, what's hidden there is powerful to be able to benefit others. But the emphasis, he says here, is how do you develop the wish to actually achieve enlightenment? If, now this is an incredible statement, Tsongkhapa goes on. If you don't have the wish to attain enlightenment through, I'm translating quite literally, so I'll have to put it in more colloquial after I read this. If you don't have the wish to attain enlightenment through the gateway of cultivating belief in the truth or reality of a Buddha's good qualities, you won't be able to turn back the mind that holds on to being content with the peace alone of having fulfilled one's own purposes. You achieve nirvana. Nirvana is a state of tranquil bliss. Right? Tranquil, you're content. Everything is, you know, it's fine. So you become very apathetic. So if you don't believe, you know, so you have fulfilled your own purposes. So how do you overcome that apathy of having fulfilled your own purposes? And he says, if you haven't cultivated belief in the reality of a Buddha's good qualities, then you won't be able to get out of that apathy of feeling that, you know, I've done enough. I'm content with this. Because if you really believe in the Buddha's good qualities, you see there's much more that you could do. Amazing. And then he says, and although it is with the wish to attain Buddhahood by seeing the necessity of fulfilling others' aims, from the gateway of having cultivated love and compassion, that one is able to turn back the mind that holds on to being content with your peace alone for accomplishing the purposes of others, nevertheless, it's necessary to cultivate the wish to attain enlightenment also by developing belief in the good qualities. Tsongkhapa gets these enormous sentences. Because seeing the necessity to attain Buddhahood to fulfill the purposes of others by itself is unable to turn back the first type of holding on to the contentment about having fulfilled one's own purposes, nothing else is able to stop it. So that is an enormous Tsongkhapa, almost like Hegel, sentence. Now, what is he saying? He's saying that you've achieved liberation. So you're very content, apathetic. Now, you've fulfilled your own purposes, but you haven't fulfilled the purposes of others. So to overcome the having the contentment of having fulfilled your own purposes, you have to, you know, really believe in these qualities of a Buddha. There's more to do. Love and compassion, if you develop that, will help you overcome that apathy about others' purposes. But love and compassion alone is not enough to get you to overcome that apathy about having and contentment at having fulfilled your own purposes. You follow that? It's very, very profound psychologically. Very profound. You know, I'm fine. So even if I develop love and compassion with others, that's, you know, for others, that's not going to help me to overcome, you know, well, I'm okay. So why should I do anything more for my own benefit? You know, I'm content, you know, and you can only, so I'm content in terms of my own benefit, and I don't care about the benefit of others. So with love and compassion, I can overcome not caring about the benefit of others. But with love and compassion, I'm not going to be able to overcome just by itself, being content with what I've done for myself. The only way to overcome that is thinking of these qualities of a Buddha and the wish to attain enlightenment. Very, very amazing what he says. Now think about that. It's very true. Love and compassion is not enough. So, like with these conditions, loving compassion is not enough. I think, wow, these teachings are so fantastic, it would be horrible if they were lost. So I have admiration for the teachings. Or look at these qualities of a Buddha. There's more that I could attain. So I have admiration for that. Or look how rare it is to develop bodhicitta. I have the opportunity to do that. There's more that I could do. That helps you to get over the apathy of, I've done enough for myself, I'm fine. And love and compassion isn't enough to get you over that type of apathy. It will only get you over the apathy of not caring about others and their welfare. Got that point?
Good.
So, Tsongkhapa goes on. Let's see how far we want to go today. He says, it isn't the case that you don't need to turn back the mind that holds on to being content with your peace alone and having fulfilled your own purposes. So, saying that it isn't the case that you only have to, you know, in order to go on to being a bodhisattva, that you have to turn back, get rid of, you know, being content with, you know, the fact that you haven't fulfilled everybody else's purposes. You also have to overcome being content with having fulfilled your own purposes. Why? He says. This is because Hinayana arhats, that's what you become with liberation, only have partial realizations and partial riddances, you know, what they've gotten rid of. And so they don't have the most splendid fulfillment of their own purposes. Right? So it isn't that you don't have to turn away, get rid of this contentment at having fulfilled your own purposes, because you haven't fulfilled, because as an arhat you only have, you know, partial realization. You still have the habits of grasping for true existence. Your mind still makes appearances of true existence. You haven't gotten rid of that. There's still more that you can do. Secondly, they are liberated from the sad disadvantages of compulsive existence, but they're not liberated from the sad disadvantages of peace, of apathy. So, okay, yeah, I've gotten rid of compulsive, you know, existence, samsara. I haven't gotten rid of the disadvantages of just, you know, apathetically, you know, here I am, you know, I'm peaceful. And the most splendid fulfillment of one's own purposes, it is said, is with the Dharmakaya, an omniscient, all-loving mind. You know, how can I really fulfill all my purposes is if I have a mind, that, you know, Dharmakaya, that understands absolutely everything, knows everything simultaneously, and has equal love for absolutely everybody. And then Tsongkhapa says, this is important to understand so that you don't turn back to Hinayana. That's the whole purpose. If you haven't gotten this incredible admiration for enlightenment, then even if you have all this love and compassion for others, there's still the danger that you're going to say, oh, you know, enough already. You know, you're not going to, there's a danger you'll fall back to this Hinayana thing of just staying with enlightenment, with liberation. And then he goes on, this conclusion of this little part. The first two ways of developing bodhicitta, which are induced by seeing or hearing about the strong abilities or good qualities of a Buddha, are not induced by love and compassion. Many scriptures explain that you can develop bodhicitta like that. So you were right. The second two have a little bit of compassion with them, of the Dharma is disappearing, how wonderful, you know, it's terrible if it disappears because it can benefit so many others. And, you know, it's so rare to develop it, so I will set the example and do it myself. That has also some love and compassion in it. But the first two ways, there's these fantastic qualities of a Buddha and fantastic powers of a Buddha and omniscient mind and so on. And so I'm going to work for that. It says that these are not induced by love and compassion, and many scriptures do explain that you can develop bodhicitta like that. But for perfect bodhicitta, you need to have it induced by both, seeing the good qualities of enlightenment and compassion. And that's something that I must say that I had not heard emphasized so much before. And Tsongkhapa makes a big point out of it and quotes various sutras to support it. Just underlines that I should have studied Lama Rinpoche more carefully, even though I received teachings on it a few times. But one has to go over it word for word, and especially when then one goes back and reads it in Tibetan and translates it word for word, and often one finds more meaning in it. So let's just digest that final point for a moment, that for a really perfect bodhicitta, we need both of these. Seeing these fantastic qualities of a Buddha, and that's really what I want. Otherwise, I'm going to be content with just liberation. So much more that I could do just for my own sake. And so much more that I could do for others. And just how much more I can do for others because of love and compassion is not enough to overcome that apathy that you'll feel because I've done enough for my own sake. You have to overcome the two types of apathy. Because remember, bodhicitta working for enlightenment takes an unbelievable amount of strength. You have to really be driven. And all of this comes back to one of the most difficult points is becoming convinced that enlightenment is actually possible. Which is all based first on having understanding what enlightenment actually is. Then, is it possible? And then, is it possible for me? And all the circumstances that I would need to even consider such questions. To even think that such questions are important. For it to even enter my mind to think about such things. And laziness and anger and greed and economic need and family pressures and so on are so great. It's unbelievable. So the fourth one, when you say, actually, I do have the opportunity to do it, and it's so incredibly rare, how can I not do it? That's relevant. Okay, let's end with a dedication. We think whatever understanding, whatever positive forces come from this, now try to actually feel it. I really want to attain enlightenment and I really want to be able to benefit others because they're so miserable. And there is a possibility to actually do it. And so by this positive force of having thought about, heard about these things that we've discussed today and thought about them, may that be a pure builder. Positive force, pure building positive force that will actually act as a cause for reaching enlightenment for the benefit of all. Okay, thank you. And think about how much positive force you need to build up to that. Unbelievable amount, isn't it? First countless eon, even to all the way to getting, being an Arya.
But the answer to how you akin the enlightened Buddha practice, that's this dedication. What is the solution for the samsara Buddha, like for the precious new rebirth, to really build up enough positive force?
To build up enough, to achieve enlightenment, for it to become an enlightenment-building positive force, you need the dedication with bodhicitta based on actually feeling it. For samsaric positive force, you need to... it doesn't have to be dedicated. It will automatically go to improving your samsara. But it has to be a constructive action, which means refraining from a destructive one. And it could be depleted by anger.
There's no way of saving that.
No way of saving that. So that's why, to actually build it up and not destroy it.
It's even more
difficult.
Difficult than enlightenment building, in fact. And you have to have the proper dedication.
You have to have the proper... Right.
To have no kind of dedication in terms of samsaric positive force, I find that very strange. It's even difficult, more difficult, maybe.
It is more difficult. It is more difficult. How do you avoid the positive force, even the samsaric positive force that you have built up, from being destroyed or depleted or weakened? Weakened is what happens. To actually get rid of it totally is only through purification. Anger just, makes it weak. So it takes an awful long time for it to ripen, and it will ripen in a very trivial, small way. So that you have to factor into with beginningless time. And I think this is what's responsible for the fact that we haven't all become enlightened yet. Okay. Well, we ended with the dedication.